quite a number of things to discuss tonight. We've got a couple of people to hear from. I think what I'd kind of like to do is run over this briefly. First, tell you what we might include tonight if we don't run out of time. I might add that about 8:15, I'm going to have to pull a disappearing act probably for about 45 minutes. And I've got another meeting that I have to at least show up to for 45 minutes or so, and then I'll rush back to Terry. We'll carry on. For an agenda tonight, in your books, we'll be discussing the federal items on page 63, which is the exclusion provision that Senator Groh asked us to consider. It's actually 63 in your front section here, the books. Just in the book section, the front section. Then pages 66 to 69 contain a number of drafted amendments by Greg that we asked him to prepare for this week's meeting. On page 70 and 71, we have a memo from Bob Dozier, which he's here to give us some additional information on if we wanted, regarding some definitions in the assessment field. And then 72 to 80, again, some more drafted amendments by Greg. In addition, just to get conceptually, there's Senate Bill 316, which concerns what?
Text anticipation.
We need to kind of get a conceptual idea whether we want to include that or not. And also, House Bill 709 passed the other day. This is an act relating to terms of office of members of school boards. And I didn't. I just threw that in.
That doesn't belong on that side of the code. Isn't that Title 14?
Well, yeah, it is Title 14. So does that take it out of the need on our part to consider it?
Yeah, I would think it would.
We don't even have to worry about it. Okay, yeah. That's fine. We'll just consider that something we don't even have to worry about. You're right. I didn't think that through. In addition, Jim Bruce, the borough attorney from Fairbanks North Star Borough, is here. And knowing of our interest in the reapportionment, he's got some thoughts that he'd like to present to us. Finally, we have some guests here from Lost River Mining that, as you're all undoubtedly aware, in both houses there's legislation been introduced which would create a new type of city called a development city. Senator Hensley conducted one joint hearing on that subject, and it's by kind of arrangement. The way the thing is slated to work is that the Senate would consider it first, although actually it's been introduced to both sides, but Senate would consider it first, and if they do, when they move on it, then we'll deal with what they come up with on the House side. However, by the present here tonight, I take it that Bob or perhaps Senator Murdy's is interested in having a pitch made for its inclusion in it. And this will be no disrespect to this group, but that time when they start to make their presentation about 8:15, I'll leave, but only because I've sat through these hearings and I pretty well know their project, and so you'll have a chance to hear it, and I don't think it's probably something we're going to make a decision on tonight anyway, but don't think I'm walking off in a huff when they start describing. So with that in mind, I think the first thing probably we ought to do, we'll take up Jim Bruce's thoughts on reapportionment. The reason I'm picking him first is we have several reapportionment pages to consider of Greg's. It's legislation we asked him to draft. So I'd like to get Jim's thoughts first, and then we may or may not want to incorporate any suggestions he has into, just any place.
What page of the new draft?
That would be pages 76 on page
80. Maybe, in fact, well, let me backtrack just slightly. It might be useful if Greg at least capitalized what he's got here at our direction, yes. And then Jim then would be in a better position to comment on that, so if it's all right, we'll do it that way.
What page are you on?
Page 76 of the book starts the amendment. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, This amendment is just a continuing redraft of the basic policy provisions that were decided on. Additional provisions have been amended in the existing Title 29 should this local option method be adopted. What we're trying to do is avoid any kind of confusion on some so fundamental a question. I don't think it's necessary to go through every provision. Let me simply point out that what we're trying to do is remove either express statements in the code that a city councilman must sit on the assembly and are appointed and non-city members are elected. We're at the same time, in accordance with the committee's instruction last week, adjusting the provision so it's clear that this is perhaps a method that a local government may adopt if it's constitutional, if they can do it on a one-man, one-vote basis. So that's what most of the amendments are intended to do. I might state that I'm going to present an amendment later on which tries to incorporate in the proper portions of the code the decisions as to when the date of election is and the decision that a local government may vary the date of election. I'm going to try to bring in a different amendment because as things stand now in the code, you've really got a situation that calls for an election on the first Tuesday of October every even-numbered year unless the assembly chooses a different election date. If that remains the policy, I want to engraft the subsequent decision that was made here about letting them vary the election date to November or something if they wanted it. I'll just bring in another amendment on that. It's not covered in this composition portion of the amendment.
You know, you set up step by step, in other words, but it still does what we basically wanted to accomplish, and that is that as long as it's one man, one vote, basically any municipality can have an assembly composed almost any way it wants to.
Right.
City representation is possible, total at-large representation is possible, any mix of the two is possible.
All I've done is try to pick up every provision in the code affected by this policy decision.
Yeah. Why do you have Section 7 there?
I might mention 6 and 7 are for our special case. It's for when the borough is first incorporated. 7 eliminates the mandatory requirement that borough assembly members representing home rule or first class cities are appointed by the city council. That's all. It still leaves the way open for this to happen. It's only one of a few places where we actually make specific reference when an appointment.
Very good.
Why don't you go ahead and Jim?
Okay, well, first, I want to congratulate you for bringing Greg back. I think that he's pretty talented. And I had some other matters, but since Mike's going to leave, I'll go right through. Well, first, my position in a lawsuit, and that is caught square in the middle between the rural faction of the assembly and the city faction. I really could care less which side prevails professionally. The chairman has directed me to take a stand that is independent and probably in the best interest of the community. I've come to the same conclusion, essentially, that you have. The community ultimately has to determine how the body should be selected. But I've done something that I'm not certain if I understand what's gone on so far here. I suspect I'm one jump ahead of you in that I have broken out the concept of the organization of an assembly and reapportionment into two separate thoughts. Reapportionment I view as merely monkeying around with lines on a map and population figures. The more difficult question is the organizational question. I spent a good part of the afternoon at Senator Murdy's request drafting. I don't know that it'll do me any good to read what I have because I don't have it typed and it's too complex. Basically, my thoughts are that you people have got to give the basic guidelines as far as the organization and structure of the assembly, period. Now that, if you don't, the courts are going to have to do it. I don't think it's possible for the assembly to do it. I don't think it's possible or even reasonable to expect the citizenry to do it. So the guidelines are not very difficult to draw because the courts have narrowed in the concept of one man, one vote to the degree that there's not much in the way of different plans that can be suggested. What I urge in concept then is that the legislature put in the four or five the most possible plans for organizing the assembly. And then by referendum with the electorate at large, decide which one of those plans it's going to choose. Now, the plans are really rather simple. Barry Jackson was up here and suggested what his clients wanted, and that is at large elections. That can be an option. I suggest that you guys not touch it other than to put it in as an option for the voters to look at. That's my plan A. With that plan, you can vary the size of the assembly as your present statute provides, under 6,005, up to 12,007, up to 30,009, and over 31,011. That's the simplest. My plan B proposal, and I don't care what number of assembly you use under plan B, I have selected 13. I didn't work through all the mathematics because it was going to take too much time. But if you arbitrarily select plan B, or the electorate would select it, you would have to decide how many assemblymen would sit. The essence of this plan is if a first-class city has 50% of the voters, it's going to get 50% of the assembly, period. If you have 13 assemblymen, you'd have to have a breaking point that either get 7 or 8 assemblymen. if the city population was less than, we'll say, 3.5% of the total population of the borough, the city could not be given an assembly. That's all there is to it under the one man, one vote.
What's that? 3.5%?
Yeah. Let me scratch it out on the blackboard here.
Sure. Isn't that putting us in the same box with old Seldovia?
Just can't give the smaller cities a seat up for themselves.
Well, if they got a 4%, then you got an 80-man assembly.
Not necessarily. What you do is you're allowed a 12% variance approximately. The larger the assembly, the better off you are. But if you have less than the 3.5%, you don't get any vote.
Incidentally, Judge Davis says 5%. Yesterday.
I know what Judge Davis says, but I'm fairly confident, given the size of the assembly, that the Supreme Court of the United States, in the case of Abate v. Munt, will be followed. I'm almost certain of this. If you have, say, from 3.5% to approximately something around 11%, you get one. If you have 13 assemblymen, each assemblyman will represent approximately 7.692 3.1% of the total borough population. I don't care how you break it down. If you only have 13 assemblymen, the population figures are going to have to be off. If you want to be on the nose, you're going to have, in Fairbanks, North Star Borough, 117 assemblymen, and that's unreasonable.
Why do you have to give each first-class city representation?
You don't.
Oh.
Why haven't you complained at all?
Basically, I'm building in an option that the city of Anchorage would want, which maybe in the Anchorage borough they'll adopt. This is one of the options that the electorate can choose. Anyway, you have two people for something around 11% to about 18%, something roughly, and it goes on out until you have a city with 100% of the populace and they get 100% of the vote. I don't know that quite frankly, the electorate is voting at large would adopt this type of plan. It is an option. I put it in deliberately, thinking of the cities of Fairbanks and Anchorage, which their city council are going to scream bloody murder and put pressure on you if you don't have a system in where they can maintain the status quo. The more assemblymen you seat, I don't care how many assemblymen you seat, by the way, under this plan, the more assemblymen you seat, the easier it's going to be to narrow down percentage points and keep your deviations. The abate fee the month, the court approved 11.9% maximum deviation. Yes.
Yeah, that's because it was historically that way for the last 50 years.
Partially.
Yeah. But that was a major consideration in the court's decision.
It was one of several considerations. Yeah.
Would you say it was one of the major considerations? Mm-hmm.
The other, there's also a sentence in that case in which the court pointed out if you only had a few locally elected representatives, it's harder than the devil to come up with equality. If you're willing to go to assemblies of 150 people.
I don't think anybody would advocate that.
I think that's a significant factor. Now, I don't care how the assemblymen from outside first-class cities are elected under Plan B. They can either be elected at large or by district. You can simply provide by ordinance how they're elected. Under Plan C, I suggested single-member districts. If you're a real liberal, probably this is what you're going to favor. There are some real advantages in it. The single-member districts, insofar as possible, should follow city boundaries, being totally within or without the first-class cities.
In your single-member districts, do you have dual service?
If the electorate provides for it. My thoughts on the subject was if the electorate in a first-class city provided that for those single-member districts wholly within that city, that the one seat on the council shall correspond to one of those districts, fine. If the city didn't do that, then the person could be elected individually. By the way, I've drafted this up in rather loose form. The district, or the number of assembly seats, then, if you go to single member districts, can be significantly reduced. You'd have 5 or 7 or 9 or 11 very easily. I think if you go to this type of a plan, you're going to have to at least have, say, 11 or 13 or maybe even 15 assembly if you're going to build in a plan where you represent first-class cities. While Craig and I were talking this afternoon, he came up with a scheme. Do you remember what your scheme was, fourth plan?
Well, it was simply election at large, but requiring the candidates live in certain districts.
Like we were doing, yeah. Which was, now, the organizational aspects commend themselves to some of the schemes that are presently in existence. I understand in Mat-Su they simply districted the borough. In Anchorage, you could have a scheme something like I have on the blackboard, or you could have Plan C requiring those elected from the city of Anchorage to sit on the council and on the assembly.
Let me ask you this question, kind of buzzing. Why do we have to spell this out?
For one thing, I think that there aren't really very many options.
That's the reason I ask. I mean, you know, the available options suggest themselves.
But I think if you don't take a look at the law, you're apt to have some group, whoever organizes, going off in an unconstitutional tract. You hold an election, and any individual can upset that scheme, any citizen of that borough, because you're not dealing in a majoritarian concept. You're dealing, when you deal with voting, you deal with individuals' rights. And you cannot deprive any individual of those rights, even if the electorate approves them. So you might as well take the bull by the horn and say, you know, we've got these options, put them into your statute, and then allow people to choose. Basically, that's all.
What could they come up with that would be unconstitutional?
Well, I think the varieties of that are infinite.
Well, I mean, the majority of people would approve.
What's that?
They've got to sell it to the electorate, too. What could...
Basically, this would not have to be sold to the electorate. You might have a squabble between rural assemblymen and city assemblymen over what one of the plans was the best plan. And you're providing that option.
You're not saying these are all exclusive either. Now, you're not forcing them to use any one of these, but you certainly are giving them advantage of inertia, I guess. In other words, you're pointing to something.
Well, I think Jim is saying that exclusively. You're limited exclusively to these four options. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, that's maybe what he's suggesting, but you could say, if they come up with any other constitution, I mean, you can write it.
Well, then you're right back to where we are.
Yeah, we're leadership, really.
I have a question. Jim, who are you representing? Are you representing John? Are you representing the assembly?
No, I can't represent the assembly.
You're representing the chairman?
Yeah, pretty much. My position is essentially the same as the court's, I suspect.
Maybe you spoke a minute ago. You were certain what the U.S. Supreme Court was doing. I think you're probably the only one in this room who is. Reapportionment matters.
Weeks readings.
So is my friend over here. I don't think he's so certain. Or are you representing John's viewpoint then?
John and I haven't sat down, and he wasn't here when I drafted what might be statutory language this afternoon.
But he approves the concept?
Yeah.
We ought to limit it to four or five alternatives?
I think that you really don't have any more.
But that's his position.
Yeah. You might come up among yourselves with another scheme. Cliff, have you?
Why don't we just say what we've done? Say you come up with a one-man, one-vote principle, and I mean, as long as you comply with those principles, come up with any plan you want.
I know what Judge Van Hoomison's feelings are. He's given them rather strongly that he doesn't want to act until the legislature has. Yeah. He does not want to apportion the room. But I think if you just say, do it, you actually are not providing any leadership. I think
we are by giving them four alternatives and say, fellas, scramble. We're doing the same thing anyway, Jim. Legislature can't do anything until that reapportionment article was changed by the electorate or struck by the Supreme Court of the state. So our hands are tied. We're saying each area ought to use their own resources, come up with a plan they think best suits them. It's got to be approved inside and outside. And if they don't, local affairs agency will do it.
Well, let me go on to the problems. I think there are significant problems in having local affairs and the apportionment. You all got a copy of a long letter I wrote. I mean, I break out apportionment as a separate function which must be done every 10 years. If you don't have a system at large, you have to have a regular method of apportioning the borough. I object to local affairs because unless you're willing to give them a lot more money and I suspect you're going to be willing to, I don't think they can do it. I think that essentially what happened in Fairbanks is going to happen again and again. They're going to come in and they're going to see a very tough political battle going on, a struggle for power. A person from Juneau or from outside of the community simply is not apt to have the interest necessary to carry through a plan unless the basic organizational structures have been set out by statute. That makes reapportioning very simple. If a borough has adopted, say, Plan D, the reapportionment that must go on is largely a matter of looking at the decennial census and seeing that the population, where the population shifts have occurred, and plugging in the right number of representatives. That, to me, is relatively simple. Although, I would much prefer if you would have a local reapportionment board look at it. My first choice is a group elected at large of maybe three people who will sit down and simply reapportion the borough every 10 years or after every census that's taken. I have no ill will against local affairs, and if you want to plug local affairs in, obviously I can live with it. It's just that I think it's wiser to keep it in the community.
Are you suggesting you don't think Fairbanks can reapportion itself right now without any guideline?
Absolutely not. Period.
And the reason is what?
I just think that the feelings are too hard on that assembly. The rural assemblymen absolutely cannot accept.
Mr. Chairman, I not only confirm, but I sat 2.5 hours on Saturday afternoon and I almost got in a fist fight and was bitter.
That sounds like acres. You're getting good.
They both hired permits on both sides in acres. It's incredible if you give it to them. Maybe this idea of getting somebody a commission in the community or something isn't in effect. The local affairs agency, the attorney, who they're living by, the attorney general, who drew up the plan for local affairs?
The attorney general's office. What happened? I can tell you right now. He got down.
Huh?
What's that?
We drew it up.
Yeah, but the scheme was theirs. The number counts were yours. I agree. But the basic scheme, the concept, was in an opinion of theirs. I just don't think that if I were in local affairs, I'd want to go up to Fairbanks where the feelings are as hot as they are.
Tell me in a few minutes, Ed, why the feelings are so high. I mean, one man, one vote is a very fairly simple principle, and they're either going to comply with it or they're not.
Well, for example, the attitude of the city is they want organizational, institutional representation on the assembly. The assembly wants at large. They want the whole community to vote. And not have the city council per se. And that's one basic difference. There's a total distrust between the city members and the non-city members. And they just will not agree to even discuss it rationally. Incredible. And you've got to take it out of their hands. Well, I don't care what you do.
You know, it's a practical matter, Mr. Chairman. We've talked about this. We've ironed out our compromises. It's 100th day. We're ever going to do anything in this code. We're going to do it pretty soon. We can't keep changing our mind, and as my friend says, walk all around on it. We either going to buy this concept or we're not. I think it's the only one that we can come up with that has any semblance of success in other boroughs. We can't just tailor it for the Fairbanks North Star borough. I don't share my colleague's attitude. I think that, given the reality, Fairbanks North Star borough can report to, I think they can, and if they can't, then let an outside party do it for them. They deserve no better. And I've told them that individually. Many of them are my good friends. I serve on that body. We can't write this code for one borough. And this incorporates a lot of compromises, and if we start retreating now, I think we're going to go back and redo everything in the code again?
Sir, nobody's asking you to. He's merely asking you to set optional criteria.
Well, this gives them all options. What makes us think that a group of people can't sit down? They're against the wall, and they really know they got to reapportion. They might come up with a 6th scheme, or a 7th, or a 10th. We don't have all the brains in this room. Let them try it.
Nobody's suggesting that. And the trouble is, you give them something to grab on. It's in the statute. It's in there now.
Well, that's the problem. We tied them down too much.
Mr. Miller, could I suggest that it may be that you're going to have to provide some leadership? And that's really what I'm asking in this area.
Well, leadership is all kinds of things, Reapportionment is a complicated subject, and down in Texas, 10 citizens walk off the street and they say, here's a plan. So the court rejects everybody else's plan, and he says, we'll take your plan. Who the hell provided the leadership there, the 10 citizens?
Perhaps a sentence at the end of this that says that any borough that's malproportioned is no longer eligible for revenue sharing.
Don't do that to us.
Some of them.
The thing about it is, you call it lack of leadership, we call it flexibility.
I know.
They were right.
They were right. That's how you like that for leadership.
Anyway. Obviously, I can live with anything you want to do. I do think that Judge Van Humisen is pretty much going to sit on it until after the legislature adjourns. Now, he may just go ahead, but he'll probably then be forced to... Well, one of the things that can happen, if you provide an option in a few assemblymen or non-adult, and you know, the ratios change, then you have the status quo built in the other side, and they're not going to give it up. We can probably go to the next census then.
Big George and the Supremes will write one for him.
Yeah, they are.
I don't know that the courts can write.
They're doing it every day. Doing it every day all over the United States.
Not permanent ones, though.
Yes, they are. For 10 years.
Well, by and large, they write one, and what's happening, in fact, is they write one for a new legislative body, and then that legislative body adopts something quite similar. I am convinced, though, that to leave reapportionment in the first instance as a responsibility, or the organization of the assembly as the assembly's responsibility in the first instance, you're just not going to get a change. There's political inertia there.
What's your idea on organization? You mean that we should set down guidelines for organization beyond reapportionment? I don't understand what you're saying.
Oh, I guess you really missed it. There, I view the organization of the assembly as a separate issue from how many assemblymen sit and from what lines or political areas they sit from. If you want to organize your assembly on an at-large basis, fine. If you want to organize it on a scheme where if a city has a certain percentage of the electorate in the borough, that's a separate organizational plan. If you want to organize your assembly on a districting basis, it's a third plan. The fourth plan would be, as Greg suggested, the election at large with a person from each district.
But under this proposal, you can take any of those.
That's true. Which gives, face it, you guys can't. If you're crazy. I haven't even proposed that they hold elections at large.
Well, but if under our plan, if under the proposed law they can do whatever they want, why should we tell them that you can do whatever you want, but these are your four choices?
Well, I really don't think that you're probably going to come up with constitutional choices.
Well, then we shouldn't make the choices. We can tell them do whatever you want so long as you comply with the one man, one vote principle. And that's what we've done.
But that's what I'm saying. If you give that type of a choice, there's an infinite variety of plans that they can come up with that are unconstitutional that the voters will approve. And you're right back at the courthouse door then. What I would like to see is for this body to come up with four or five constitutional choices and let the voters of the borough choose from them.
Well, but if there's an infinite number, we can't have it both ways. If there are an infinite number of plans, then we shouldn't endeavor to say choose from these four or five.
Incidentally, you could have a malapportioned assembly under your four or five without a lot of difficulty as well.
The plan won't be unconstitutional, though, Terry. What I'm trying to avoid are unconstitutional organizational plans. Now, if you can set up a plan that will clearly meet the constitutional test, then the reapportioning is a very simple matter, and I basically outline my ideas on that in a letter.
If you just put those four in there, there's lots of additional variations on these four that might just fit a borough to a T, and yet it wouldn't be available to them because it's not one of the four.
I don't know what the...
Well, for instance, I don't know why a borough would want to do this, but they want to do. They could have the rural assemblyman elected at large, but the city assemblyman elected by district.
That's right there. Yeah. Huh? There's no problem with that.
Well, then...
Basically, that's it.
Then they could have it at large in the city and separately at large... well, that would be to Tacoma, would be...
I agree.
I mean, I see lots of varieties other than just this four that you're talking about.
Well, that's a variation on this theme.
But why should we set those out? Why should we just...
I don't think you should, and that...
Okay, why shouldn't we just say, so long as you comply with the one-man, one-vote principle, go re-abortion yourself? What is the advantage of our saying, well, okay, but when you re-abortion yourself, you do it at large, or if 50% of the voters are from the city, they get 50% of the representatives, or you can go to single-member districts, or you can elect at large, but you have to live in the district. Why should we do that?
Because, quite frankly, I don't think that there are that many variations after this.
Well, then there isn't any problem anyway.
Terry, there is, because I'm convinced right now that you're going to very possibly get the assembly off on a track where the plan itself is unconstitutional. I don't care how many people approve the plan, one person disapproving who can show that the plan harms him can upset it. These plans probably, in my opinion, can't be upset. And there's a heck of a lot of difference between ordering a new plan and ordering a political line on the map to be drawn a little bit further over to include 100 more voters and exclude 100 voters.
Well, if you asked me to build in no institutional representation into the code, I'd say no.
Oh, I'm not asking you to.
Well, but if we're going to leave it open, why don't we leave it wide open? Let them take any plan they want. And obviously, if some citizen is dissatisfied with it, he's going to go and take them to court.
Furthermore, the assembly will not be, I presume, without legal advice. And if they want to take the calculated risk of going ahead with a plan that could well be unconstitutional based on their legal advice, then they're deserving it. They want to take those kinds of risks.
I'm not certain for those votes in the interim on issues which may be of great importance to the community, that is a very sound approach.
Well, you're going to have that anyway. How are you going to decide which of the four you're going to do? You're going to put it up to a vote, and each plan gets, one plan gets 25%, the other one gets 23%, and one gets 17%, but no one's got a majority. You're going to have a runoff between planners.
Mr. Chairman, I have a suggestion here. Obviously, it's not being sold. It's something that maybe we can put as a committee report in the journal as a suggestion for anybody that wants to do it when we submit to municipal code, because it's obviously not going to go in. There's apparently good reasons against it. Let's get on and just spin our wheels on this.
Sure.
I mean, I'd like to have it. That's one method, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. We can say this is a, because we mentioned that when we submit this, we may put that in the journal, and then they can look at the journal if they want to take it, rather than writing it in the law. And I think it's probably wasting our time spending more time on it. It's not going to get in.
I did have a couple of comments. One of them was quite simple, and that is, when you finish, I appreciate it, whatever you do with the code, assuming that it passed, that someone like maybe Greg be hired to write an index and some annotations to prior statutes. It would be exceedingly useful.
You mean on a cross-reference basis or something?
Yeah. All the statutes need that. But this one's going to need it very definitely, and you happen to have some people here who've already worked on it. The other thing I discovered, and I almost died when I discovered it, unless there's a change made, and I thought it had been made, and it's my fault for not noticing it sooner, that's on page 64.
Of the code.
If I understand what was written, it knocks out the flood insurance program inheritance under federal statutes, and I don't have my statutes or federal regulations with me, so I want to check.
What line?
This would be line 4 on. I had thought that this was going to be a straight grandfather clause. In Fairbanks, we adopted a limited building code for flood insurance purposes. The federal statute reads that the local municipality shall have building code powers or something like that. The borough assembly adopted a very narrow code strictly to meet the federal criteria. However, we have to have that power under the federal provisions. and this could be pretty significant if just I would recommend a straight grandfather clause right here. If you have a code in effect for limited purposes, as far as a building code goes, it should be allowed to stand. I realize that this is a compromise. I thought it had already been taken care of.
Mr. Chairman, put this in focus. What we're talking about here is the authority over building, housing, and related code. Under present law, it's been construed that the borough has this as part of area-wide planning and zoning. Under this code, one of the changes is that cities are within boroughs are permitted to exercise power in the future. And a special provision, that's C, here at 64, talks about what you do with the present situation. And it says that a borough which, when this act takes effect, is exercising building code powers on an area-wide basis or in the area outside cities shall, subject to acquisition of it on an area-wide basis if it's done just outside cities, exercise the power in the borough outside cities. And if the city agrees within the city, if the city does not agree, the city exercises. So this is your situation as far as the existing boroughs go. The city wants to exercise the power within cities, it may, under this code, and the boroughs can find exercise outside unless it goes to the petition election route to exercise area-wide. It is a concession, in effect, to cities. The question of how this affects flood control powers, I believe, was hassled over at public hearings on this particular provision, but my memory failed me as to what the analysis was. I thought that as part of area-wide flood control powers, which the Fairbanks Borough, I understand, has, you could exercise whatever building code requirements are necessary for flood control purposes, that is how high foundations should be and what kind of wiring must go on the foundations and what have you. But
I'm not certain that the federal statute just says building code, and then it sets out a list of criteria. You have to build so high and you can't have windows in certain basements, and you can't put...
Well, do you feel that the city would not give this authority to the...
I don't know if this satisfies that statute. I suspect.
Do you have a proposed amendment?
I just discovered this about 6 o'clock this evening.
Would you prepare one for us, maybe to leave it with Greg, and we'll consider it? We certainly don't have any intention of cutting on the road.
Yeah.
Is there anything else I want to mention? Since I pretty well drafted up proposed statutory language, I'd be glad to have it typed and given to you if you want.
We'd like to have it for reference, but in all honesty, I don't think we're sold on it. But don't feel bad because all of us will be able to tell the rest of our friends here.
That's the only one we wouldn't shoot down. I'm concerned because I think I'm going to be back next year.
Well, we can't agree on what time it is.
I wish we hadn't gotten in the hassle in Fairbanks. It wouldn't have made any difference, but we have. Incidentally, many of the boroughs are still unconstitutionally apportioned. I know Kenai is.
We have. We've hassled this at half of our meetings have been devoted towards this, and really, we've hassled all different kinds of things, and that's what
we come up with. That maybe instead of local affairs coming in, that you have an independent board elected at large in the community. Maybe some advantages to that.
Nonpartisan.
Yeah. An at-large election.
We appreciate the work you do.
Thank you, Jim.
The one suggestion about having this annotated, it sounds like a particularly practical thing. I don't think anyone's even thought of it. Incidentally, my suggestion for you that perhaps after hearing from the Lost River people, we might want to take action on Greg's suggestion on the apportionment. I think we've heard all we can hear on the subject.
You may be back by then.
Yeah, right.
I'm here from the Lost River people.
Bob, the fair is kind of orchestrating this thing, I think.
Bob, are you coordinating this effort? I think several members of the local government committee have heard
more votes in one assemblyman than the other.
You've heard of them, Jeff.
I'm familiar with the local government.
How about you, Jeff?
What?
You heard it? Lost River proposal?
They ought to be awful brief.
What are you trying to do?
It's not a question. I just want to know if maybe you could home in on certain areas if some members have heard it. That's all I'm suggesting.
Just real fast, the development city concept has been talked and discussed. I'm told in the Attorney General's office for 2 years, and there's been a lot of talking, a lot of discussion. But the one project that stimulated create or the public sector create. This is a little different approach than the mining people we had in Juneau. We managed the outside the city boundaries and outside school boundaries. Fairbanks, Cordova, Nome, in the same way. This approach says the major industry and the economic base is in the city boundaries. And within the city boundaries, they have an expectation that we use the tools of the trade to develop a community. You have your normal capital programming, you have highways that the state does, it has your airport that the state does, and this one here says you'll have your highway people, your aviation people, and your hospital people look at their priorities and programs and zero in on getting this project and matching the industry's play at the same time. And that's so that's alternate A, developing a freestanding regional service community, which will not only serve this one particular industry, but also initially we feel that will serve to reduce a freight cost. We compute that as a cost benefit ratio on that basis of probably 1.75 to the harbor facility that would be required. And Corps of Engineers builds a 101 and stretches the debt out for 50 years, and that's a feasible project. This one, cost savings to the people in that area or the users of freight looks like $3.5 million to $4 million per year. That's one of the regional benefits. If we go a public facility and the town is public, now there's an alternate, you can have a company town. So you squeeze down everything and you have it private. You don't have to incorporate the city. There you have the mining plan. So we've been presenting the three alternates and how it works. How it works. Way. This here indicates that you want the public sector doing its job, that is providing the public facilities, matching with the local effort, which will be a tax on the community, on the facility, federal aid, and there is federal aid for new communities and new projects, and there's federal aid for when anything is going to expand jobs, using those tools at the same time. So there's no free lunches. It requires the state to do its responsibility as it has in any city. And you have grant programs for sewer, water, and so forth. We'll be developing a city along the city line instead of a company town line. And that's really what that does. It was limited to just city, and from various suggestions, conceive that possibly you would want to expand an existing city boundaries and give it a designation of a developing city. What it means is you zero your resources from the state level and you zero in on assisting that project to go into a small postage stamp city. An example is Cutwine. There's a possibility you may want to expand the city in that area to make that one go. There's another possibility that instead you may look at it just developing a service area in an existing borough, and you give the borough some extra powers that you normally don't have that you're in a development stage. And that's what that does. Considering what our constitution is and what our tradition is and what we have as aid programs to cities, that's what this bill represents. The Canadians have combinations of capital and public sector working. They got bigger and stronger tools in that area. They can provide transportation on an equivalent of state basis, a province basis, where we don't. They can pump out a railroad for 500 miles to a development site and on a contract agreement with a developer. We can't. We can only pump a road in that area. But it's a coordinated prior planning approach to getting development. So you don't have the environmental problem to clean up after you put the people in the town. This is to get it set up before you let the people in the town, because there ain't anybody there. Plan it orderly, put the facilities in on an orderly basis, which is normally cheaper.
construction of the mine is done, you have a town where the people are going to live there in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and it's going to draw a more economic place. That's generally the theme of developing the city. And
two basic items. The Attorney General called me up today and said that he sees some serious problems forming the bill. He's for the concept, the three commissioners are for the concept, and he asked if it would be all right to work it out with Greg and develop the concept. They, the administration, would like to see it put in, but on a basis of these objections that they had in the form of this bill. So I suggest, Mr. Chairman, rather than take any action on it tonight, that we would authorize Greg to work with John Hadlock. He asked for the opportunity to work with Greg to come up with a red line. Is that what he said to you, Greg, what they talked about?
Well, he is going to take this draft tomorrow and work it over before the committee meeting.
And I would suggest we call him down and make a decision on it.
Well, why don't you proceed with your work with Hadlock, get it into a form that's acceptable to the administration, and at that point, we'll see if the committee wants to pursue it. If so, perhaps we can bring Hadlock down and go over. It may not be necessary if the administration approves.
Some of the problem is that we wouldn't be burdened with this thing here. One, it's a late start on the part here, and there's an incorporation bill, and the reason for the incorporation bill is we've got, you know, we can show you the reports and some of the preliminaries that set up, but the problem is matching the public sector with the private development sector. By December 72, things have to be firmed up in the public sector. So the Incorporation Act then will allow the public sector to present an application to HUD for the new Community Facilities Act of 1970, which you end up in those areas that you don't have federal grants and so forth. You end up borrowing at 100% with state federal guarantee bonds, tax bonds for the communities. Well, roughly, when you consider the housing that's in there, $15 million for the housing, when you consider the public sector that's in there, another 12, so you've got $30 million to fill the public sector in housing. Now you can do it either that way with this bill, or the developer can do it as a private developer. But you lose a little bit, first you lose some federal grants, you lose some percentage of your guarantee, you allow some profit on the thing, which is not the case the other way. You end up with a company town again. At that point, you don't have to be incorporated for these people to move. This way, you end up with a town and all the public facilities are owned by the citizens of the community when we get done. You end up with a facility that can have a multiple use in an area that needs a multiple use of public facilities. That's what we got.
Just one final thing, Nicholas. Senator Hensley wanted to turn that, Mr. Chair, and he feels very strong about this, but Senator Christensen needed because they wanted development at Lost River, and he asked me to mention to the committee that he would have been here.
Well, Senator Hensley will be given an opportunity to make a case before the committee after the Attorney General works with him. Great.
I agree.
Absolutely. He, you or the other gentleman with you, have anything you'd like to add?
Does anyone do an alternate seat?
Well, we was explaining that any industrial developer who may approach Alaska has possibly three approaches. One is to see if it's worthwhile for them to be bothered and so forth with the approach A, which can be called the regional expanding approach, and thinking about the multiple use, and that's in this bill. B is a pure company town where you're going to have processing on the site, and but you're going to build the facilities tighter, cheaper, and you're really not looking too much for a long-range approach. Company C, or alternate C, and in the mineral areas, is what we've been getting in Alaska, the pure high-grade, the mineral fine. What you do is you put a minimum amount of facilities into the area to mine it, crush it, and you ship out and get the processing done somewhere, and you'll run a six-month operation, as the case may be, and run it as cheap as you can. we have a barite operation in southeast Alaska. That's exactly the way it goes. The open pit mining is done. Everything gets slurried onto a vessel, and believe it or not, it's shipped to Hong Kong for $5 a ton. Singapore for $5 a ton. When you consider that some of the transportation costs we have coming up, and how people can ship out for $5 a ton around the world, something else. But we're not getting multiple use out of that one facility. And I get back home. This is somebody, the industry has alternates to doing things when they're approaching Alaska. But on the Canadian side, I think I'd like Ron to explain what goes on the Canadian side and from Australia and their operations. He can explain how development towns are going on and what has happened. Why don't you just explain the Canadian and what the population base is from this approach?
Basically, what you...
For the records, could you give your name, please?
Ron Sheardown. Basically, I think the closest operation you've got to here is the Anvil mining operation in Yukon. You've got the White Pass in Yukon with container ships working between Vancouver and Skagway in your own state, moving ore one way and freight the other way. You've got a new town that's been, I think it's been expanded again this year. The mine has been expanded again. It's basically, it's about the same size of operation that we're looking at for Lost River. They're moving 300,000 tons a year of concentrate out, and I'm not too sure what the percentage of freight inbound is, but I know that it works about, I think it's about a third cheaper for a general cargo delivered in Skagway compared to what the people in Skagway pay. That goes on into the Yukon that they get no advantage of. We're looking, the type of vessel that we're looking at would put freight into the local area for about half the present cost. Nome, Kotzebue, on through the general western Alaska region. In fact, as I stated the other day to the other group, a ton of freight delivered in western Alaska with a two-way haul should be cheaper than a ton of freight in, say, Anchorage. We've got 20,000 ton vessels working between Seattle and Anchorage with probably about a 10% backhaul. There's no outbound product of any consequence. It's very minor. We're looking at 35,000 ton vessel with a minimum of 300,000 tons a year of product going out, and there's no reason why you can't take at least a third to half of that tonnage outbound into Bering Sea ports. And when you have a deep sea harbor and you can handle containerized freight, you reduce everybody's cost of living in the region. The next area farther east has a specific case of new towns would be Pine Point in the Northwest Territories on the south shore of Great Slave Lake, where you've got a large lead zinc operation. The Canadian government built a 600-mile railroad from central Alberta into Pine Point and negotiated a contract with the company to guarantee usage out of the railroad for 10 years. In that period, they expected to get to generate other traffic, timber, and other resources around that railroad. We've got several such railroads across Canada as far east as Labrador in the iron ore country. It's basically, the government does the same thing. They'll step in and build a railroad on a long-term contract. In the case of Pine Point, there's been some question brought up of this being put into the developer's hands in this bill. In the case of Pine Point, the total project was put in the hands of the company and administered by the company.
Yeah, I'm trying to see the cost involved in the state here and what's the return. Well, is there anything you can compare with what they've done over there? And
in a tax return?
Oh, yes.
Any
kind of income return.
Right. Well, on the railroad, it makes money.
It sounds like we're going to be going in the proposition of
the same. If the city owned the harbor site, we would expect to sign a long-term contract with the city for the usage on that harbor, and we would have to guarantee the usage of the dock. Guarantee so many tons a year for X number of years of product over that dock. We're not expecting anything for nothing.
Would it be developed without any pre-planning?
Without any pre-planning from the state's part?
Pardon?
Say again.
If the state didn't participate, it would be developed, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we've given the alternates to developing it. You go in and high grade it, and you do your processing, and you're, instead of 300 or 400 jobs on the, locally in the area, then you put a processing plant in the middle of Japan somewhere where you've got deep sea facilities. Things like your waste do heavy use, being a high calcium limestone, you've got use for cement, fertilizer, or there are other uses for the waste, the tailings disposal. But what you would do is just put strictly a crushing operation. No ancillary facilities of any consequence would be required on the project. You just went and high-grade it, slurry it on the ships, and go to bigger vessels, cheaper transportation rates, and put your processing out of the country. And you might run on a 6-month, and you'd bring in a contractor to do it. You wouldn't operate on a permanent scale.
He impressed this local government committee with the seriousness and the financial muscle behind this project and the actual resistance he knew and so forth. Presumably you talked about that. Could you briefly tell him just some of the high points you told us about what you have in mind doing here and the type of metal that you're going to get and what you're going to do and so forth?
The product?
Yeah.
Well, basically we're looking at 300,000 tons a year of fluorite. Approximately, I think it works out to around 5,000 tons of tin a year would be, and tungsten would be shipped out. The fluorite, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's basically used for the manufacture, or it's in the smelter for manufacturing aluminum and steel, and there are many other chemical uses. For every ton of aluminum produced, there's 150 tons of fluorite used as a flux in the furnace. And for every ton of steel that's manufactured, they use 12 pounds of fluorite as a flux. Even down to ordinary electric welding rods, there are certain high-quality welding rods that use fluoride as a flux. It's used for water treatment at city level, toothpaste, right? Again, all your hexachloroplast has fluoride in it. There's many uses for it. Basically, what we have in Lost River is a very large market demand. There is a world shortage of fluoride. It's an 8-year world reserve, and a projected doubling of consumption in the next 5 years. So there is a crisis sort of thing in the fluorite market, and we're in an ideal area here to get involved in that market on long-term contracts. If you go too long, other deposits come in, and then you lose that advantage.
How far is it from the sea?
5 miles.
And you need a deep water harbor.
There's no economical way that you can move that type of product without a deep water harbor. Barges, there's just nobody. And the other thing is too that you've got interest charges on stockpile and things like that. If you operate on a 5 or 6 month shipping season with ordinary vessels, you get into critical points. You've got to work at a 8-10 month. We figure out with the design ship we've got it would be a 10 month operation.
Wouldn't you slurry it to the sea?
Pardon?
Wouldn't you slurry it to the sea? Would you slurry it into the sea? You wouldn't.
No, not if we. I don't know if we could. I don't even know if you can decant without retreating here. I don't know what the environmental problem is. I think they're running into that problem with the hog barn, I think.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, but it may be that you can decant and go back on shore with your wastewater that's brought out of the ship. The other way is you can go to straight conveyor loading too, high capacity conveyor loading, same as they do in the iron ore industry, and still end up with it. With a dock, but then you have to have a dock situation, or you can go out on island piers.
And are you associated with any major mining company, or is this a local enterprise?
Ourselves, well, we're out of Toronto. We're a Canadian mining company, basically.
Further questions? Pete, do you have anything you'd like to ask?
Well, Senator, the good committee, I think the delay was too long. I know you caused the late working a little late, but if you would bear with me, hear me out, I'd just like to make a few remarks. own. I do have a few years behind me there. I just wish I had that many ahead of me. I feel that you folks have a big decision ahead of you as legislators, and I feel very humble, and I thank you very much for allowing me a few minutes here to give you my ideas on a little development in Northwest Alaska. As you know, Northwest is probably the biggest depressed area under the American flag, and we trust we're still your allies. And today I feel very proud to stand before you and say that at long last, instead of more government and asking for more dole, I can proudly say that we have an economic base out there. It's been drilled and evaluated, an ore body that's better than 20 years. And looking at about 300 to 400 jobs in the biggest depressed area in America. It's tidewater. It's the Pacific Rim. It meets the president's and administration's wishes for balance of trade, because the majority of this product is now being looked at and wanted in Japan, because they do have the corner on the shipbuilding and the metal market. However, they're very dependent upon resources, and I'd like to say that the president of our company is in Japan for the last 3 weeks meeting with the various companies, and this is about his third trip over there. And they're looking very seriously at this because it is tidewater, it is the Pacific Rim. As I've often told the Japanese parties who have visited the area for the last 3 years, that it's all downhill to them. It's easy. It's tidewater. You look at the globe, that's the way it is. But I think you as legislators have a decision to make here, and that is, does the state of Alaska want to develop its natural resources? If so, the Canadians have developed what they call new cities because they're resource-minded, and they've oriented their thinking to that. And just across the border here, as Ron pointed out to you, they've been doing that very thing. They're landlocked and they use our American ports, Haines and Skagway. And we in Alaska have been looking at Canada for many, many years. If they can do it, why can't we? We've got the biggest coastline, more than the United States has. And if we're to open up Northwest Alaska for its minerals, the hard rock minerals, the gas and the oil, which we hope we do have out in Northwest, and now just north of us at Lisburn, Point Lay area, there's one of the biggest coking coal deposits in the world, some 100 billion tons, guesstimated. Guesstimated by the USGS, 100 billion ton of coking coal. And that is being looked at by the Japanese. But the biggest problem confronting that area is a deep water port. This firm, Lost River Mining, have been in that area for about 4 years, drilling this deposit at Lost River. They would like to present to you this new town concept, and I'm sure it's going to be used, if implemented and adopted by the state, in many other areas of the state. And I mention this coal deposit because it's been known for many years. In fact, the whalers, when they were whaling up around the Point Barrier long before Nome and the other areas were struck, they used to stop into these coal bluffs. There's 35, 40-foot exposed seams, and with these old whalers, and load on that coal and take it south. After Nome was struck in 1900, when they went to the steam boilers, using that for thawing their ground for prospecting and underground mining, they used to bring that coal back to Nome, too, and use it there. But there is a real impetus now and a push being put on to looking for natural resources and the hard rock minerals. And if we are to develop a real program for hard rock minerals, then I feel we should really take a hard look at this new town concept, because it's government joining industry and developing a real model city.
And here's a chance for the state of Alaska to take a good hard look and plan and program in a reasonable, proper manner and take into account all the ecology and the environmental aspect of the thing so that you can ensure that it'll be done in the right and proper manner. So, in summing it up, I'd like to ask you gentlemen to give this your best thought. And I do think that this new town concept should have been adopted long ago, and I'm sure you're wrestling with it now, and in the future you'll be wrestling with it again. Take the North Slope, Poudre Bay, Dead Horse, and Service City. I think you've got a topsy-turvy deal there. If this new town concept had been initiated 10 years ago, maybe we wouldn't have some of the problems we have today in the North Slope area. But I think the greatest benefit will be the jobs, the cash flow, and hard rock mining, and mining as such is labor intensive. And it's can be, if this our port were developed, it'll bring 8 to 10 months shipping to the area. Coincidentally, just the other day, Foss Tug and Barge announced that they were asking the Federal Maritime Administration for a 15% increase across the board on all waterborne freight into the Bering Sea area. Believe me, this comes as a real jolt again, and it's another albatross around our neck. Water transportation should be our cheapest transportation, and the aim of every carrier in Alaska, be it land, sea, or water, has been a two-way haul, but to date Alaska has been a one-way haul, all inbound and very, very little outbound. So this is another consideration that should be considered, and that 15% increase to the tariff is really a low blow.
Pete, how far is this from Nome?
It's about 90 miles up the coast. It's about halfway between Teller and Tin City.
Up the coast?
Yes, right on the south side of the Bering Sea, on the south side of the Pacific Peninsula. The other thing I'd like to say in closing is that if we're ever going to get some development in the state of Alaska, and especially that northwest area, then hard rock minerals as such would then give these regional native corporations with their monies when they are funded a chance to invest their monies into the various services so that they can perpetuate their funds. Otherwise, the state of Alaska and will never be able to earn its $500 million, which is supposed to be the 2% from oil, gas, and minerals. We do not know this hard rock concept of mineral development in Alaska.
Just one point.
Yes.
You see the chart that Assembly Hensley had that showed the native selections and native townships.
Yes.
There's native townships, state area, and federal area right in that.
Yes, there is. And I'll ask Ron that maybe we had him as well.
No, I saw the map. I think the committee has to know about that. But that, I guess that's why they actually, the natives are so interested in this, because they see it as an opportunity.
Yes, we have been working very closely with them. Especially with the Bering Strait region. In fact, I met with their president of their organization Sunday, and they're very optimistic on this, or very interested in it, because it all it will do is enhance their land and the value of their land. And it means jobs for their people and a chance for them to invest their monies and perpetuate their funds and grow.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Greg, how many minutes have you worked out? By number, I'd say most of them are relatively minor, should take 30 seconds or less.
Okay. Gentlemen? Bob? Cliff? Joseph has one to discuss too.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Bob, I want to hear from you next. That'd be a good one.
Okay.
Okay.
You want to see more?
All right.
Page 70 of the book. Bob, go ahead.
I'm Bob Dozier with the Local Affairs Agency. I just have two or three, actually four or five cleanup amendments which I have suggested to the in a memo to Mike Miller. The first amendment, as you, I have two memos that I've, and you have copies of both of them. The first subject that I have covered has been already amended by the pre-conference committee, and consequently, I it took care of the problem, and there's no further comment really on that, on number one. The second part has to do with the definition of market value as stated in the bill. I have suggested here that the word change in two, I have a little difference in the two memos in the definition. The most important factor involved in the definition change, I feel, is the terminology that is used, which eliminates on normal payment terms and puts in its stead and under the then prevailing market conditions. That is, the full and true value is the amount which the property would bring on an open market and under the then prevailing market conditions. The on normal payment terms does show intent. However, it's too restrictive and really doesn't define all of the conditions which must be considered by the assessor. The term under the then prevailing market conditions is an all-inclusive term and have reference not only to normal financing, but indicates that the assessor must consider all of the prevailing forces which affect supply and demand. Normal financing terms differ in the various classifications of properties and according to valuation levels. This definition would seem to me and to those who have suggested it, the assessors in the various areas, that this would take in the whole, in one term would be all inclusive and be more appropriate. Before we go on to the other factors, is there any questions on that particular point that you'd like to make?
The generic term and the general term, of course, is prevailing market conditions. You and I'm sure anybody in this business knows that if you have a cash sale, it's going to get less for your property than you do if you have a payment scale or a 30-year or 20-year payoff. And prevailing market condition really doesn't address itself. The question of the manner of payment. Because the market, prevailing market price for a piece of property could be $10,000 cash on the barrelhead, and you may be able to sell it for $15,000, or vice versa if you had long terms. Now, I'm sure that's what they had in there originally when you talk about normal payment terms. I can see an assessor coming in now, maybe not you, but an arbitrary assessor, say, well, the lump sum price of this property, or you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
And I'm wondering if you addressed yourself to that point. And if you have, fine. If you tell us that then prevailing market conditions embraces the orbit of 30-year mortgages and cash payments and so forth, fine. Now, I think that's a crucial point, and I frankly am suspicious of assessors, not you, Bob. I'm suspicious of them generally. And I think that the committee at least ought to have a statement on that point.
They're suspicious of lawyers, too.
Yeah, it's mutual, isn't it, Bob? Right. Well, anyway, I'm sure you got an answer.
I understand
to that.
Your point there.
Well, Bob, let me ask you this. Suppose you put it under the then prevailing market conditions in a sale and left the normal payment terms in there.
Yeah. And complement each other.
Well, you would sure tie it down then.
I sure would.
I have a question. How did the new language get in there?
Huh?
I beg your pardon?
The normal payment terms is not in the existing code.
Yes, it is.
No.
Oh, no.
How did it get in there? What prompted it?
Somebody
Bill
snuck,
here?
Somebody snuck it in.
Bill, did you sneak this in?
Don't take that. On normal payment terms?
Yeah, how'd that get in? That's not in the existing code, I don't think.
I thought this definition was the one local affairs and the rest of us accepted from you years ago.
This came in years ago, if you're right. Frankly, I don't recall. This has been running through the municipal code.
I believe we started. Not
as long as I've been familiar
with it. This is in the code now?
No, it's been in the draft of the municipal code.
Yeah, well, you don't know why, then it's changed.
And I don't recall how I got in the first place, Gary.
How about you, Dave?
Gosh, I don't know. I have to defer to Mr. Dozier here. Well, the present statute that just goes on to after the assessment, the January 1st assessment, in determining the full and true value of property in money, the person making the return or the assessor, as the case might be, shall adopt a lower or different standard of value because the same is to serve as the basis of taxation. Nor shall he adopt it as a criterion of value the price for which the property would sell at auction or at a forced sale, either separately or aggregate, with all the property in the taxing jurisdiction, but he shall value the property as some which he believes it is fairly worth the money for timely assessment. That is the present statute in total. What this terminology here, as Greg pointed out, was something that was brought together by a group of us who tried to put together at that time something that would be appropriate.
Well, Mr. Chairman Bob, would you object if we put under them prevailing market conditions and less than normal payment terms in there?
No.
Okay, I would move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I just have a question. What do you normally mean by normal payment terms? 30-year mortgage on a house, 50-year financing on a warehouse?
On each type of property, Terry. On value ranges of financing. It'll a normal financing on one type of property is FHA, for instance, housing financing is at one level. And
that's
here
in
Juneau,
it's
entirely different.
No.
Yes. Normal payment terms is in the this article.
It's in the new code, but it's not in the existing law. Okay. Well, there's a motion. Do I hear objection? Put them both.
How would that read now, Mr. Chairman?
Let's leave them on normal payment terms also.
An open market under the then prevailing market conditions in a sale on normal payment terms.
Is that all right, Ed?
That sounds like the kind of thing the assessors say in their preamble. The appraisers in their preamble with their standard for.
Okay. Without objection, so ordered.
We've
amended it.
The third section of this is not very important, and I really don't know that we should take too much time on it. I did have a few comments on the wording. It says you strike after notice, add a period, and strike all subsequent wording, which means allowing 30 days notice for the changing of heirs. Now, this is entirely, we're not talking here about changing evaluations by the assessor. Here we're talking about clerical errors, heirs which have made in the making of the rule and preparing of the rule, and many of our jurisdictions do not have a supplemental rule, and many of our jurisdictions don't have provisions for having it going on well beyond. They want to the time limit of setting the mill levy should be stopped at some reasonable time, and the mill levy set and the roll certified, and at that time no further adjustments made unless there is a supplemental roll. And as I say, there's only two or three of our jurisdictions who have supplemental rolls.
How does the existing law read?
Bob, what are you trying to do? Striking out allowing 30 days for appeal to the board?
Yeah, for peers.
Yeah,
not for evaluation adjustments.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, but the heirs may be, a taxpayer may be complaining and saying you're making a horrible error. Not just a mechanical or a typographical error, you say, hell, Europe says to me 30 and I should be 5, and so you adjust it to maybe 29 and you never give any notice it.
How's the existing law read? I'll ask again.
I mean,
well, the existing law doesn't really cover this particular point, as I recall.
Yes, it does.
You have 30 days to appeal the assessor's notice. He sends you a notice to your assessor, you have 30 days to appeal. Now, what this means is that if you notify the assessor that there's an error in your assessment somehow, and you make the correction, you have to send out another notice, and then you get another 30 days, and that's what you're trying to remove. It delays the final confirmation of the assessment.
You don't have that in existing law.
I don't believe that.
There is, yes.
There isn't an exact development that I can find off in what I'm looking for, but I don't see exactly how it is.
I believe this 30-day provision was inserted as a request at public hearings years back. Somebody brought up the point that it's unfair not to give a period of time to appeal the corrected notice.
Mr. Chairman, I would have no objection to that if it was a mechanical error or something, but there could be a brutal mistake, and the poor guy never going to get any notice.
It is in 411, Bill.
It is an existing law, this way?
411? It says here
this is at a later stage of proceedings, Bob. That's why I say it's not exactly acknowledged.
No, that's true. It presumes here in this statement that the adjustments are made before the Board of Equalization.
Yeah, this allows for a change prior to going to the Board, and 411 is a change made after it goes to the Board.
Is this?
Here's the closest analogous section that I can find, at least. But this is a different stage of the proceedings.
Well, how the hell is this going to hurt anything, Bob?
Yeah.
Like I say, it's really not all that important. These other things that I had, I felt were more important.
Well, then let's go on to those.
Yeah, I don't like cutting those off.
Mrs. Gallagher, the borough attorney, raised the same comment.
Unless you want to cut the time down a little bit. I wouldn't eliminate it entirely.
I might cut it down by 10 days, two 10 days would help.
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, okay. Now, item 4 is the hearing. Now, unless we have strike or and, which means it has to be proved. Now, appeal for adjustment of assessed values is based on facts stated in a valid written appeal timely filed by the assessor. Adjustments and valuation are made by the Board of Equalization only after considering evidence as stated in a written appeal and the evidence which has been prepared by the assessor pertaining to the appeal. Now, in this bill, it provides that the burden of proof is on the taxpayer, and he shall make an appeal on written form as provided, and that the assessor is also required to submit a summary of data concerning the property appeal. Now, the evidence is, after the board has considered all evidence as properly and timely submitted, it shall then render its decision. The word change or to and clarifies and defines that all adjustments must be properly documented and supported by facts. This change is intended to make it clear that adjustments and valuations should not be made arbitrarily by the assembly without proof and substantiated.
They never do that, do they?
Never.
Wait a minute.
This is a fairly substantial change in policy, I would think. I don't know. Most people don't prove their claim.
It's an understatement.
I don't know. Mrs. Gallagher raised the same point, I believe.
How can you prove? Let's prove by a mere appeal.
That's what I don't understand.
Dramatically.
Well, it's documented and supported by facts.
I know, but Mr. Chairman, my attitude would be shifted just the opposite, that the assessor must prove his case and presumptions in favor of the taxpayer. I mean, really, the poor guy's having a hell of a time now. I've represented him, and I never saw such arbitrary action.
Right now, it says for proof, which means that.
Isn't it true that the staff and the time and the full-time effort is certainly more capable in the hands of the assessor than the poor taxpayer? Well, he should have the burden of proof instead of the taxpayers.
Well, but there's other sections that take care of that. Listen, let me ask you this. Suppose we strike or approve, which at least will make it sensible.
Yeah. No, I think you've got a different reason being brought up. What it is, I'm afraid that you're going to get into, have your colleagues, excuse me,
almost common law pleading. For example, if you switch this to an N and you make a valid written appeal and the proof does not conform to the appeal, you have not